Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to a new episode of Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer, and I have with me my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Philip.
And we have today's guest, Trevor Scholl. Hi, Trevor.
Hi.
So, who is Trevor Scholl? Let me quickly say a few words. Trevor is Associate Professor for Culture and Media at the New School in New York City. He has been developing and promoting a set of models for building worker-owned and democratically controlled online platforms known as platform cooperatives, something that we will talk about during this episode. And further, Trevor is author of several books on the subject of platform labor, including his latest one, which is called Own This, How Platform Cooperatives Help Workers Build a Democratic Internet, published last year in September, if I'm not mistaken, and Uberworked and Underpaid, How Workers Are Disrupting the Digital Economy, where he basically introduced the concept of platform cooperatives.
And let's start from our usual question. The podcast is titled Talking About Platforms, and so we welcome people that in different ways talk about platforms, and our beginning is always with a double question: how you end up in the world of platforms, and what is a platform to you?
Well, I mean, if you still remember MySpace, this online platform that hardly anyone talks about anymore, in the late 1990s, and now I feel really old, early 2000s, you know, I was reading Tiziana Terranova, her work on network labor, and spending some time on MySpace, and I thought like, wow, this is actually really feels like labor. And, you know, I called that data labor, and, you know, started to convene like conferences about it, and people thought it was really crazy. And especially, you know, like, how is this possibly labor? You know, this isn't labor. So there was a lot of discussion around this. I convened like some conferences around it and started really looking at compensated platform work. And so Amazon Mechanical Turk and these similar platforms, and gave lectures on those. And in 2013, actually in Berlin, I had sort of like a key event where I spoke at the Republika conference, and was a very large audience, probably like 2,000 people or so, and introducing them to this material, I really could see them sink in their chairs, right? Because how gloomy this material was, with people being novice workers being paid 1 to 2 hours an hour and dollars an hour. And I thought like, well, this is not really what I want to do with my life. It sort of motivated me to think about, you know, like how could you actually intervene in this model? And then I guess sort of my personal like life history came together with that. You know, I've been in cooperatives all my life, and so it was not that hard to think like maybe there could be an angle here to think about how these principles that drive cooperatives could be applied to the digital economy. And it's sort of the last push was given by an Amazon Mechanical Turk worker, whom I invited to a conference in 2014, and she ended the conference by sort of pensively looking out of the window and saying, what if we just start our own platforms? And then boom, you know, like I stayed up all night and started writing. And I mean, all of that comes against the background of this I mean, you know, now there is a whole, like, you could fill shelves with books on this topic, right? Like about the power imbalance between workers and platforms. So, you know, like there's, in terms of access or pricing or platform rules, like workers have hardly any say. And or access to customer data, right? Or just sort of the general lack of agency. There are, you know, gaps in labor law. All of this is, I feel awkward even repeating this because that's so well rehearsed by now. But, you know, these gaps lead to low pay, miscategorization as workers, as independent contractors in many cases, lack of job security and benefits, lack of oversight, and so on. And of course, also a threat to physical safety, which we see a lot happening in the platform economy, misuse of user data, algorithmic bias, the isolation of these workers. The focus is very clearly not on well-being. And on top of that, you have this sort of incredible concentration of corporate power. You know, like a lot of discontent. Well, there was one study that you may be familiar with where 75% of people feel that they are discontent with this current model in the platform economy. And I think the last point there I want to say is that it's also largely migrant workers and immigrants, right, who are doing this work. So, yeah, and out of this, essentially, I coined this term of platform co-ops, but really to embrace this concept or to spell out this idea of what would happen when you apply these principles that have been used by over the last 200 years by cooperatives apply them to platform work. And so platform co-ops was sort of like an attempt at that, basically to say that, you know, what about forming organizations that sell goods, services, primarily through a website, mobile app, or protocol? And so, you know, I don't know if everybody who listens is familiar with these principles, right? So like I said, over the last 200 years, the over 1 billion people that are engaged in cooperatives worldwide follow these principles that spell out to be, you know, voluntary and open membership, democratic member control, member economic participation, autonomy and independence. So this sort of guarding it against socialist style cooperatives, right? Like you saw in Africa and other places. Education and training, information, cooperation among cooperatives, and concern for community, which significantly addresses this Rosa Luxemburg concern of 1899, which I'm sure many of the listeners will immediately bring up and say, like, well, but Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Marx, you know, didn't they say this doesn't work? And, well, you know, it's also worth pointing out that co-ops started in 1844. Rosa Luxemburg was speaking roughly 50 years later when there were really only consumer co-ops. So what we are talking about is really worker cooperatives and multi-stakeholder cooperatives, which did not exist at that time.
The first part of the platform co-ops concept. So you shared some interesting definitions and characteristics of the co-op. But what is the platform part for you? Like, when are you talking about a platform? What's your definition of a platform?
Well, we extend this it could be an app. It could be also a protocol or other online spaces where people congregate and interact. Right? I think the protocol part has become more important because there are also DAOs that work in this way now and protocolary cooperatives, right? So we want to not frame this too narrowly.
In the prep, I looked up for some examples. Austin, you provide some in your book, and it felt to me that many platform co-op examples bridge the digital and the physical world. So maybe that's a feeling. The majority is bridging the digital and the physical vis-a-vis purely digital. platforms. Do you think this is like inherent to the platform co-op concept, or is it only that, or not only, but or is it the fact that like local context is so important and the labor part, the physical labor part, is a very, very, very important motivator for the workers to engage and start their own platform instead of just adapting like a digital, purely digital tool or app or something?
Right. So like very importantly, and I just really need to say this, can't say this clearly enough. So from the very beginning, like, I mean, literally from like 2014 on, like my second sentence was always like, this is not techno-solutionist, right? So the idea is not here to like create an app and solve all problems in existence. But it is, you know, it's not a panacea, right? It's not the one solution. It's not a silver bullet. I mean, literally, I said that really, literally, like, really, this was like my second sentence when I ever talked about this. But somehow people, like, whenever you talk about technology, they think, they must think this is the answer to everything. Well, obviously not. So it's, you know, it's in tandem with legislation. It's in tandem with other cooperatives. It's in tandem with social enterprise, with unions, obviously, you know, many other possible alternatives and responses, right? So you can see like the fair work model is maybe another approach as well, right? Like pushing back at the situation that I started with, right? That I described in the beginning. And what you describe is like exactly right. And I think just going back to this point that this is definitely not about techno-solutionism is the fact that really what we see from having seen these hundreds of collectives work, right? It's definitely not, the technology is not the biggest problem, right? Without any question, the biggest problem is really people, right? So it's collective action. It's collective action that is the key problem. And the technology is not without problems. It's not a priority, but clearly secondary, right? I mean, absolutely without any question. So in a tradition of cooperatives, they are, of course, local. They are, of course, often small, especially worker co-ops. And then they form alliances, right? So when you look at Italy or Kenya or other places, right? So it's like cooperative scale, not by creating these gigantic companies, but by creating networks, alliances, collaboratories, consortia, right? This is like how the whole like cooperative movement in Italy functions, for example, right?
Well, you know, when you mention Italy, we are actually working with one an organization that that get cooperatives together. So you actually spot a light on something we're working on. And I was wondering, mainly thinking about our listeners, about two questions. On the one hand, if you can make any example of platform cooperatives that maybe you present in the book, just to give a bit of context.
Yeah.
And since you touched this culture of cooperatives in a certain way, I was wondering if you can clearly state the difference between a pure cooperative and a platform cooperative. So where do you see the difference?
Like? Yeah, it's very clear. I mean, the definition that I introduced makes that distinction already, right? So the key difference is like primarily, this word primarily, right? So it works primarily through a protocol or a website, right? So where the key over the last few weeks, in fact, I looked at like 5,000 co-ops or so, and basically tried to see, right, like how their business is really absolutely dependent on the digital component, right? And then they fall into this realm, right? So I can give an example. Let's just start with the one that I use in the book, which is the Drivers Cooperative. That's how the book starts off. And which is right here in New York City, like very, you know, who would expect that, right? Like in the middle of, you know, in the heart of capitalism. And but here, essentially, a group of drivers came together in 2020, and together with a former Uber executive who had worked in Kenya, where she had to wear a bulletproof vest to meet drivers, and thought, well, this could be done better. transportation expert who emigrated to the United States and a PhD student, the three together, and also union leader, right, the PhD student, these three together sort of initiated this cooperative, which has now, 3 years later, right? I mean, it's barely 2024. 12,000 onboarded drivers, has paid out over $7 million, has introduced a solidaristic measure of a $30 minimum wage. So that means that passengers or not, those drivers will always be paid that. And has started a driver's academy, which is also unheard of, right? When you go back to this principle that I just introduced, education was one of them. When you think about the platform economy, right? Education is, I mean, these platforms would not educate their workers because they're completely replaceable, right? So that's what you can see there. There are so many interesting things about drivers co-op. So it's the vast majority are immigrants from South Asia. And so who really have, for the first time, like a voice on how to run a business. And so now they have a license to hand out taxi licenses, which means that more and more drivers will come to them. And once they double that number of drivers, which I think is quite realistic, like within a year, I think they will have 10,000 more drivers, then they are really in direct competition with Lyft, right? So far, and this is interesting, if you want to understand this model, it's quite dependent on support from municipalities, right? So historically, but also with platform co-ops succeed if there is legislative support, right? So here, the mayor's office has given, there's a program of the Metropolitan Transport Authority, which runs the subway, right, which is one of the oldest in the world, and cannot really accommodate people with disabilities, wheelchairs, etc. So there's a whole fleet of cars that is paid by that same authority coming out of a lawsuit in the 1990s, that is in charge of transporting people with disabilities because they can't take the subway. So the drivers cooperative is a large part of this program, which is basically assigned a large number of rides to them every day. So it is not the pure competition, right? So because that would simply be too hard, right? I mean, that's just a very hard thing to master. And we see a similar model in San Diego, where there is also a collaboration between the city, the union, and a taxi cooperative that try to give favorable conditions for a platform co-op so that they can succeed, right? And that story repeats really around the world, right? So this is part of the success. Another aspect of it is when infrastructure is shared. We only have so much time, but the drivers cooperative started by buying software in India. So they didn't spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think they spent $6,000 for the software, which they could not make open source, but they could use and customize as they wished. And that was kind of terrible, but it worked. It was definitely not competitive as a software, but it was good enough to aggregate drivers, right? So, I mean, you could use it, right? It wasn't competitive. But then they made money, right? And with that money, they started building their own app. And so now they have their own app, and that app, they now want to create a social franchise so that co-ops around the world can use it. There are dozens of countries where people want to start using that software. You know, they are starting this slowly. So now it's in Colorado, but they're really from all over the world. People want to start using that. So shared digital infrastructure is a way to scale, right? The size differs, right? So you have some 90,000 people being part of something called smart.coop, which maybe you know in Germany as well. It's quite small in Germany. Much bigger in Belgium.
And it is Italy. the freelancer co-op, right?
That's right. The freelancer co-op. And there's Stocksy with some 1,800 members. Sneedsmap in Turkey with 1.5 million. But most of them are small, right? And also, just like any other business form, right? Like, it's constantly iterating. So it's not like just a static model, but it's sort of people really trying out what works. Things fail, right? The music co-op for musicians here in New York has failed, for example. I don't know if I even want to call that failure. It's just, it didn't work as a business, but there are lots of lessons, right, that are passed on. And I think one of the biggest one is really that many collectives don't really think of this as a business, most of all, right? They get so interested in the governance, right? Which is important, right? It's exciting to run a co-op, of course, but that can't be the emphasis, because in the end of the day, you know, what good is all the democracy if your business fails, right? So there were examples of groups that basically spend years on writing bylaws. And then the business failed. Okay, they sort of passed on their bylaws, which are now used by other people. So probably the best bylaws workers can ever write. But as a business, it didn't succeed. So there's sort of business focus, right? So we see these sort of pro-worker benefits, right? Like that I just mentioned, the self-managed minimum wage for taxi drivers. In some sectors, like care, and also domestic work, we have seen the income double for workers simply because you remove the middleman. There's, of course, this sort of voice in the workplace. So this, which comes then also with a degree of control over the collection of data, you know, which data should be collected, how should they be used, so whom should they be sold. After 5 years in business, they become more resilient than other business forms. And there's also a roughly 5% higher productivity, as we've seen from all employee-owned companies. But this plays out all across the sectors, right? So we work with fisher people in Kenya, right, who try to implement this. Fisher people in Mexico try to implement this and try to think how they can use data to benefit their operations, right?
When I think about how platform co-ops emerge, I think about a group of people that are like quite probably idealistic, more like an idealistic movement. But then at some point, especially when you talk about buying software, I think the group has to get more and more like formalized, organized when they grow, maybe also building hierarchies. Are there some like common patterns that you see how groups come from being very like driven by the idea of building this co-op to then getting to a certain size where it's just mandatory to build their organizational like structures?
Well, you know, like how sort of skeptics would say, you know, like how could co-ops ever work? Isn't this a total mess in terms of management and stuff? But what they do is they
hire... That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, but it comes to the same, comes out to a similar point, which is that they just, you know, hire management, right? As Mondragon does in the Basque Country and as these larger cooperatives do, right? I mean, it's only the difference is that the management is accountable to the workers, and the workers can fire management, right? So it's a democratically decided rules that are enforced by management, right? And so what you have in these organizations is a much faster turnaround of management because they do get fired, right? So and also they don't really have power, right? So it's really a sort of more they are literally presiding, right? In the truest term sense of the term.
Connecting to this, I was wondering if moving from the, let's say, early bunch of people that have the vision and actually create the platform cooperative, I was wondering if growing and enlarging it, do you see a pattern of issues coming between the new members entering and the initial set of people?
Well, this is a big problem in Italy, right? This is maybe where your question comes from. No, absolutely, right? Absolutely. So, like, there's this culture and, like, you know, diehard commitment to these values, right? And it means everything to these founders, right? And if people just step in, they don't necessarily have that, right? In Italy, you have the problem that the newer co-op managers have been basically through corporate training, right? And what they bring to their job is not, they are not really cooperators very much. They are just sort of business people, you know. And that's a problem. So, and there are lots of problems. I mean, the problem of scaling and also of even building teams in themselves, right? Like, to build a team that can function as a business is not easy either, right? To have complementary skill sets, right? So when a bunch of friends have a good idea, and because it's a good idea, they get money, so they get a grant, then suddenly they have this business, and then the business grows, which doesn't at all mean that they have the skills to do this, right? You know, they can grow on the job, obviously, but there are limits to that, right? So these are all sort of lessons, I think, that came out. And then this is why you see some of them not succeeding.
I think it's interesting because on the one side, we are touching an issue that is common to platform. So actually scaling it up is on the one side needed to have the platform business running. On the other hand, when scaling, you start seeing issues and problems that when you are very small, you can go on without those issues. And, you know, hearing you talking, it kind of remind me of some stories that I read in Cloud Empires, the book by Vili, that was actually here on the podcast as well. And, you know, it wasn't talking about cooperatives, but it was some kind of talking about movements and this idea of scale entering as an issue to that culture was common in many stories. I was wondering if in the cases you analyzed, or anyhow in your experience, you found any variable that can help this growing process to be smoother, or some common trait among those that actually became bigger without losing that identity.
Hmm. Well, what you point that to is one of the key problems in cooperatives, right? When they scale, and they are, you know, I think certainly in the United States, there's this perception that co-ops are kind of tiny and kind of almost irrelevant, which is absolutely not true, right? It's really not true. And it's certainly not true globally. They're very large, right? So, I mean, in the United States, you have like Ocean Spray and Cabot Cheese and II and Ace Hardware and all these things. And or in Germany, you have Rewe and Edeka and all these things. And, you know, like, they don't really make anyone's heartbeat faster, I think. But they are significant in size. So that means that, you know, what does it, you know, mean to be a member of II, which is a sort of, you know, hiking store, outdoor culture. where you can become a member, but not even the people working in the store are members, right? So what that means is that, you know, the larger these organizations grow, there's very often a problem with them sticking to these principles, right? And yeah, that's definitely a question. And this is really like just something they have to work on, right? I mean, that's a big challenge.
A comment to that. So my research is mainly about platforms in the business-to-business context, the different organizations or businesses interacting with each other. And what I see there, first, I also see some like platforms that are owned by the businesses that interact with each other, like Tapio being one example for the wood industry, where different companies along the value chain, also very, very small companies, basically came together to also buy or develop software together that helps them to track materials along the whole value chain and position themselves as an industry better towards users and buyers of the wood, which are also then mostly bigger businesses. And what I also see is that like it is not really extremely necessary to reach high scale in these type of platform like ecosystems where the ownership of the platform is distributed and where it's mainly about generating a common value together vis-a-vis focusing purely on network effects and bringing in new users and working towards a winner-takes-all market. So if you have a very clear value proposition that a platform should provide to the participants to reach a common goal and share the value, I think it can be no like real disadvantage to stay smaller, to stay local, and to stay really focused on what you do.
Right. So when you, well, like I said earlier, right? So like the way they I think successfully scale is through federation, right? So there are examples like Co-op Cycle in France, which, well, started in France in Paris, but now has developed a digital infrastructure that is used by some 80 worker cooperatives, right? And growing by the day. So they stay small, right? But they are aggregated in these federations. And so you see that with Drivers Cooperative as a trend, you see that with Co-op Cycle as a trend. You see it with Smart, which is in 7 European countries, right? Customized, right? Because the law is different in Germany than it's in Italy. So it looks a little different, but they are all sort of similar, right?
I recently quoted the book Platform Revolution. And when I also prepared for, or again, prepared for the interview with you, I looked for platforms where the participants revolted and maybe took over. So a platform in a revolution in another sense, but I couldn't find an example where that actually happened. So have one?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a complicated story. So in Toronto, there was Foodora, like one of these big food delivery platforms, and they unionized. I mean, I don't know if this falls under your exact purview, but they unionized, mostly driven by the workers. So not so much the users, but the workers. And as a result, the company left Canada. And so it created this vacuum, which then was, where platform co-ops were conceived or at least considered, right? And they were all kind of, it's a very long, complicated story. But they certainly spoke with Co-op Cycle about this as well. There was a similar example in Brussels, where very similar story. Mensakers in Barcelona also came out of unionization. So I think what's interesting about that is that there's this sort of pathway of how they are sometimes founded, where they are the result of unionization. So So platform workers organize as they naturally would in Catalonia, right? It's Catalonia, of course, anybody working will immediately organize. And so they formed these riders, recheros, right? So like riders for rights. And then a union took them on and they launched this big strike. And as a result of which, it's again complicated and complex, but de facto, they basically had no work anymore. And then basically, just to survive, they started a co-op, right? And I think this is also a story that continues, and I think is one that that you know, when you go back to, I don't know, Kropotkin, right? It's idea of mutual aid, right? Like when people are in crisis, they turn to each other, right? And this is how you see very many cooperatives emerge, right? They are a response to people falling through the cracks of markets, falling through the cracks of community safety nets, maybe even through the net of family safety nets in the global south, right? And as a response, they turn to each other.
You know, Trevor, this is the first time I actually take time to reflect on this idea of platform cooperatives. And I think it's really interesting because it's very coherent with what we do when we talk about platform thinking. So seeing in the world of platform a kind of model that can be used to reach certain purposes. And so you enter somehow in the cooperative culture, and you see in the platform a tool that can be used to reach better results, wider results, faster results, whatever it is. I was wondering if you ever met a case, an organization, or you got in touch with something that do the other way around. So that setting up a platform in a more business-oriented perspective, in a more classical perspective, got inspired by the cooperative culture in setting up the norms or the revenue sharing or the value propositions of a, let me say, traditional platform.
Yeah, absolutely. No, sure. I mean, the problem is, right, once you, if you don't go in with the intention of starting a cooperative, you take third party funding, which means that you create dependencies and you are not autonomous and independent. So, which creates this problem of essentially you have to buy out the investors. But there's this exit to community model that a colleague has developed, which addresses that. I think in general, I felt like when I was at Mondragon, they were a bit skeptical of that because Mondragon being the largest worker co-op in the world, I spent a year there, almost a year. And they really emphasize that, you know, that these organizations from the very beginning should be cooperatives because it creates very many problems down the road, right? So the great thing about cooperatives is essentially that the principles are sort of immutable, right? So for example, right, I work at the New School in New York. I don't know, you may know it like for Hannah Arendt or like, I don't know, any of these people who worked here. We started in 1920 with a beautifully phrased manifesto, right? So these founders had wonderful ideas about no tenure, and it was like very radical and beautiful. And today it's a corporation like any other, right? So how did that happen? Well, because with strikes like any other day, right? Like it was constantly, workers constantly strike here. And the reason is that those beautiful values and great declarations that always read well on landing pages of these companies mean really very little unless they are reflected in organizational structures that are immutable, right? So when you go to these social enterprise sites and you see, you know, like many even talk about like, you know, about cooperation or, you know, we are a collective doing this or that, right? Well, this is all great, right? Congrats. But the question is really like, how is this really reflected in the business structure? And if it isn't, then this can go away at any second, right? Like there's new people coming in, something goes wrong, and boom, you know, the whole thing is essentially not really working democratically anymore. So this is important. And that's the argument essentially for, I guess, starting. But there is also an argument for starting the way you describe, accumulate users, right? And then try to flip it, right? And this Exeter community, I think, is trying to do that.
Trevor, before we close, I have a like more personal question, which is how do you see like your role on the one hand as an activist forming this engaging like narratives, the like an utopia in your book, in my opinion, like thinking about an economy running on platform cooperatives, and on the other hand, being the scholar analyzing what is there, trying to understand what is there. So how do you see like your role in between? Are these even two different worlds, or do you see this as like working together, going hand in hand?
Well, let me just maybe close with a like Angela Davis quote. Huh? How's this? I just read this yesterday night and I thought it was quite beautiful. She said that you have to act as if it were possible to radically transform the world, and you have to do it all the time. Right? So, of course, there, you know, so we had like influenced policymakers in so many countries, right? In the UK and the US, like President Lula champions public cooperative hybrids based on platform co-ops. In Argentina, we were like acknowledged by the Argentinian Congress. In Germany, we worked quite closely with Andrea Nahles and the SPD. The United Arab Emirates introduced a law to promote the formation of platform co-ops. And in Kerala, India, you have the government putting the creation of 4,000 platform co-ops in their plan for the next 5 years. So, but not really your question, I know. It's quite unusual, and I think really not easy, right? Really not easy. So you have to have kind of a bit of. I think what I really cared most about when this sort of started in 2014 was to make it to grow it, right? So, and whatever it took, really, right? So in the beginning, this was really mostly community organizing, right? So we have a big conference every year, right? We had one in Berlin a few years ago in the pandemic, so that was complicated. The last one was in India, the one before in Rio de Janeiro. This year it's in Kenya and Mombasa. And so that's, I think, a big part of it. And then, but then I saw, okay, so now I feel like, well, this has really sort of stabilized, right? And it's not going to go away. And there are lots of people working on it. We work with organizations in 60 countries. It's probably around like 2 million people involved or so. So it's pretty significant. And so now I feel like I feel like an academic turn almost, right? Where I founded a research institute, you might know, here at the New School. So we have a fellowship every year, 10 people. And our new cohort will be announced in a few days. So now this is 43 PhD students that really all work on this topic. And we bring them together this summer for the first time. They will all meet. So there's an academic aspect, there's a community organizing aspect, there's a policy aspect, but this is not really how academia works, right? With the holy trinity of research and teaching. But you know, we did all these things too, right? I taught like 1,800 students from 2020 to 2023 online and teach research seminars on this as well, but it is different, right? And it's not easy to, you have to be quite confident to make that case in academia, right, for this profile, right?
So, you know, we usually close with a question looking ahead. So what are you working on right now? You actually told us some of the things you are doing. You just published a book, so I don't know if you're already working on the follow-up, but what are the ideas you think to work on in the next months, in the next years, that you would like to highlight?
Well, I think it would be, we are working, I'm working on this conference in Kenya, which is interesting to engage with all these Africa. It's a Pan-African conference. And it's November 6 to 8, so people can join if they are able to. And then this gathering in June here in New York, which brings basically all these researchers together. But I think there's lots of interesting research questions. Like one, for example, is to really focus on worker rights. So when you look at, to really research and really know for sure if these larger cooperatives really ensure workplace rights, care, well-being, you know, for women, for marginalized groups in the gig economy, they all say that, and there's some evidence that they do. But to really show that they do would be better. I just worked the last months to actually track the this ecosystem, right? Because in difference to other business forms, people don't need to report this to the government. So it's actually kind of hard to know how many groups there are around the world. So we are sort of constantly trying to stay on top of that. And then to think about, like, research questions would also be like, you know, what strategies and models are most effective for scaling these principles in different cultural contexts, right? So, and there are endless legal questions. So one of our fellows just published a paper on thinking about incorporating distributed international platform co-ops like Stocksy, right, that has members in 67 countries. And making this legal in the global south, which it isn't. Like, for example, in India, you can only be a member of your co-op in your state, or sometimes even a smaller unit. So, like, really just in your locale. And so the laws need to be changed to accommodate that. So there are lots of research questions. There remain to be, organizational questions and to really sort of sustain this international movement, right? Very exciting.
that is very exciting work, no question about that. So we are definitely going to link your institute and also the upcoming conference in the show notes. Is there any other way to follow your work or maybe even get in touch if someone is interested that you would like to highlight before we close?
The very easy, right? Through the website. I don't know. This is maybe in closing, I think like one thing also to think about is there is this, and this is maybe going back, maybe not the best way to close, but that there's a sort of very Silicon Valley way of thinking about scaling, right? Which is always like larger, more effective, more people. But I think, you know, like there can also be success in small and in large cooperatives, right? So it's more about like a right sizing, perhaps, right, of those businesses, like scaling wide, scaling deep. There are all kinds of ways of scaling. So that's maybe something to walk away with as well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.